this Cambridge Analytics thing is pretty crazy. So the background on this whole thing is that this guy, Chris Wiley, Christopher Wiley, was kind of whistleblew against this firm that I think he helped co-founded or was part of the founding team on, called Cambridge Analytica. And what they did is they had this quiz app. Their job is to kind of help companies with analytics and marketing and things like that. And they wanted to build a huge repository of data around U.S. voters for the purposes of helping with President Trump's election. And they created this app called, I don't know what the name was, but it's like a personality app, one of those personality quiz type things.
Oh, goodness.
And the crazy thing about this is that 270,000 people downloaded this app and connected their Facebook profiles to it using your standard sort of login with Facebook, connect with Facebook flow. And because of the way that Facebook was set up at the time, but it's still largely kind of set up this way today, just 270,000 people downloading, installing, and connecting to this gave them data on not only just those 270,000 people, but in total, 50 million people that were also friends of that original user group. So it's like when you connect your Facebook account to a third-party app, like this Cambridge Analytics app, just to take a personality quiz to find out which Harry Potter character you are or whatever, it then gave them access to all of your friends' information too, as part of like the permissions you grant the app. So it's pretty wild. There's a lot of like controversy. It's just the sort of like latest scandal in the sort of Facebook saga that's been really kind of going on for the past couple of years now. And they seem to be really careening toward a place where they're going to wind up getting regulated by the government.
So how does that work? I mean, how do you want to talk about third-party apps and kind of explain how that's all integrated into our digital lives?
Yeah, with Facebook Connect. It used to be that you would have to, every time you wanted to sign up for a new product or service, you would have to kind of recreate your profile details and add photos, add your friends into it, and kind of do a lot of this sort of manual, repetitive activity across every different place you had an account. And oftentimes, you would recreate your sort of login information, so you would use the same email and password, which is kind of insecure, or you would have to keep track of all these different email and password logins. And so Facebook made this really easy for everybody by creating Facebook Connect, which allows you to kind of tap a button on an app or a web page, connect your Facebook account, and then that app or that third party can then just pull your information from Facebook to fill out a profile to help you find your friends on that service, and to use that data however they kind of want to. And this is generally, it was a really good thing. It meant that a lot more apps could be more successful because creating an account and joining it was a lot easier. They became a lot stickier because you'd have an easier time of finding your friends or inviting your friends to use those new services. I think this mostly had a huge impact in like games. This was around the time that gaming on Facebook was really big and there was Zynga.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it was just about Facebook becoming the portal to, or the sort of provider or the gatekeeper to a lot of your personal information and getting that into the hands of third parties and in what is supposed to be a responsible way. I mean, that was the big promise that Facebook was making, is that, you know, they've figured out a system that'll make it easier for you to create accounts on third parties and to bring your data to third parties. But Facebook would sort of look out for your privacy, for your security, and figure out how to walk that fine line between giving people too much access to data and giving them access to data that's ultimately going to make the world, more efficient, more open, more connected, etc. It's not an easy line to draw, and these systems are really hard to design correctly, because you want to be permissive. The world would be better if there weren't bad actors out there, and if you could sort of make your information available, it would be a lot more convenient and easier, I think, to do a lot more on the net. But then there's always this risk that you run as a provider like Facebook, where you can get exploited in the way that they have been, and in a way that's creating all this controversy surrounding the company.
So does this work with, is there anywhere else where we see this with these third-party apps where this is getting transmitted, like in some of our other more popular apps?
Well, you see Android as a platform and an ecosystem is notoriously leaky and insecure where it comes to privacy and your personal information. It's very easy for apps, if you think of Android as a platform in the same way that Facebook is a platform, where apps run on top of it and you put personal information into it and apps coexist and there's all these different systems for how data moves around and who has access to what. Android is kind of deficient in this area. You find that it's really easy, and this is me speaking as like a software engineer. It's very easy to do things like just get the user's location on Android. I don't think you even have to prompt them in the way that on iOS, if an app wants to use your location, iOS pops up a box where you have to say like, yes, grant my location, you know, access to Uber or whatever. On Android, I think you can just kind of like take it without prompting, or at least historically you've been able to. And it's just in iOS, apps are much more sandboxed, so you can't access, like, Uber app can't access Facebook apps information. On Android, it's a little more permissive, and so you do see these sorts of things, but you've always seen this kind of, if you give these guys an inch, they'll take a mile kind of thing, where all these apps, for instance, like when you grant them access to, say, your contacts, you'll see that a lot when you're using an app, especially social apps, where it's like, hey, Facebook would like to access your contact list or whatever. Almost always when you grant that permission, the next step is for the app to literally just upload your entire contact list to their servers. I mean, that's basically what happens in that next step.
Is that what happens? I thought it just gave them, like, access to your phone during that time.
Well, it does. So it wait does, a minute. But when in you... that brief window, it can grab all those things and upload them to their servers.
So when you relinquish contact access, does it then delete it from their servers?
No. It just closes the window for them to be able to continue to access it.
So any new contacts they wouldn't get.
That's right.
Does it, like, you know how in on iPhone, on iOS, in the contacts app, you can put notes and stuff?
Yep.
Does it upload any notes into their servers as well, like phone numbers, emails, everything?
That's a good question. I don't know the full extent, and this may be different nowadays. It may be a little different what it gives you access to or what it doesn't give you access to, but I don't think that it gives access to contact notes. I think you can get the basics, like name, email, phone number, and that sort of thing. And the way that most of these apps kind of work is that they will grab your whole contact list, upload it to their servers, and then compare it to other people's contact lists. And that's how you see things where it's like, oh, hey, Mike is also on Snapchat. Like, add your friend based on your contacts.
That explains all of the LinkedIn spam emails that they claim are, they're not really spam because they actually came from LinkedIn, but they swear that you opted in for those.
Yeah.
Oh, that's like so terrible.
And the thing that's so, and the thing that's so compromising about it. I feel so violated. Yeah, totally. But here's what's so compromising about it is that even if you have good privacy hygiene, where you're like, nope, no access to location, no access to contacts, no. If I give it access and you are in my contact list, your information is now on record on their servers. Like, there's this whole thing, if you, and this is like, because there are folks who are like, yeah, I don't have a Facebook profile. I never signed up on Facebook. Like, I knew what the deal was from the jump, and I just didn't want to be a part of it. Even those people have what is called a shadow profile on Facebook. We all have what's called a shadow profile on Facebook, which is the profile they've built on you based on other people's data. So when somebody else talks about you in a chat on Facebook Messenger, when somebody mentions you in an email that's connected to the Facebook ecosystem, when somebody's contact list goes into Facebook with like you as one of their contact cards, like all of that is used to build profiles out on you. So whether you've signed up for Facebook or not, there's a profile and targeting information about you on their servers. It's really bonkers.
So essentially there is really no way to have like this pure privacy you think you have on social apps, etc.
It's quickly getting to the point where you would have to completely recuse yourself from society and the internet and like friends and all of this stuff.
You'd have to be, what do they call it?
Like a hermit?
Yeah, a hermit, but off the grid.
Off the grid completely. Off, yeah, you'd grid. Have to be, right, you would have to really go live in the jungle or something to totally get off of it. And it's scary, you know, and the thing is, it's like everybody sort of knew this all along, right? Like, is there anybody in the world who's surprised that Facebook has a creepy amount of information on you? Or I mean, not to like necessarily pick on Facebook, it could be Google too. Google has probably just as much of a sort of profile on you as Facebook does, maybe less defined or less of a sort of, like, I think Facebook's data is probably a little stronger. You know, they have, I think, a little more data on interests and connections and...
Sure, but there's many platforms that have a lot of data. I mean, I don't know that anyone would be surprised about the fact that they have some data, because it's obviously they can see your pictures when you're uploading pictures of your family and friends and whatnot. But the surprise comes in partly what they do with the data, how they use the data. I don't want to say against you, because in some cases it could be for you. But it's the things that are completely not transparent that you would have no idea. For example, how you talk about third-party apps. And now when I turn contacts on my iOS, how they store all of that information up in their cloud without deletion.
Right. That's the thing. I mean, anywhere where they're going to be able to try and grab anything that might offer insights into you, they'll grab it. But the flip side to this is that it is kind of useful. You know, it is sort of useful to be able to do this, like to compare if you're, you know, like, I don't know. I mean, I think this is really going to be one of the big political focuses of the rest of, I mean, government officials who are calling for regulation. There are bills, I think, starting to be written about regulating big tech. And it really seems like we're heading in that direction. Yeah. But the crazy thing about it is I just don't know. I would not want that job of having to craft a system to hold these people, like tech companies, accountable and keep them. Because I don't think the challenge here is I don't think these guys are necessarily acting like Facebook. And this is one of the things that executives have been kind of tweeting and putting out there in reaction to this Cambridge Analytica thing, is that like there wasn't a breach. They were like, we weren't breached. We weren't hacked. This is just the whole system kind of functioning the way we built it. Like, this is what Facebook is.
It was supposed to be doing.
Right. It's a feature, not a bug kind of situation. Yeah. And
well, if we get into regulations, I think everyone can agree that it shouldn't necessarily be just the government, especially and if they do not understand technology on a deeper level. There has to be some thoughtfulness in going into that, whether it be a think tank of all the brilliant people who are in technology and understand it, who may not have a direct benefit from doing so, to who knows what.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's the thing, though. I can't think of many examples of where that's happened, where like they've pulled the world's experts together to figure something out, and like a really great piece of legislation or regulation kind of came out of it. I think it's really tricky.
It would have to come from us speaking up about it. I mean, you don't need that for, you don't necessarily need that, say, for example, for something like mortgages, although I could, we can have a whole episode on how I feel about regulations that have come down in the real estate industry and on in mortgages and whatnot. But that takes, that's a very different understanding than what we're talking about. So I don't know, but imagine if people got together, and especially like the younger generation, and were very, very vocal about wanting something like that to happen, and getting it in the news, that could be a step in that direction, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I think maybe step one would be to really clearly define what an ideal situation would look like with regards to people's data and privacy and what rights we have with how corporations like Facebook are able to access and leverage that. It's a really hairy topic. I mean, you know, like the, and I,
you
know,
that
I
may, get, to your point, that may be a better thing to look at. Like, what are our privacy rights? And
yeah,
then how does
that's
that
kind of
get implemented in the industry?
Exactly. You know, I think like there are some things there that I think could be very useful. Like, you should be able to, regulations should make it easier or seamless to be able to take your, Facebook would call it your social graph, but to be able to move your network, like, you should be able to move your network as easily as you can switch your website off of Squarespace and put it on WordPress.
And delete your data from the cloud if you want to delete it from the cloud. Like,
you should
be
able
to be transparent and, absolutely.
That, absolutely. Yeah, there are definitely some sort of, like, fundamentals that we could really achieve. That would be really interesting, is to, like, get, and I think it's going to happen. I really do think that we've kind of crossed the Rubicon of, like, people being aware of their data and being aware of how their data and the services they use can be leveraged to make them do things that, or to just cause, all the ways that these things have been negatively leveraged over the past couple of years to.
Hopefully we'll see one of our listeners with a change.org petition for this.
Yeah, that would be great. You know, but I mean, it's like I'm also a little concerned. So today, very tragically, a woman was killed. This was the first autonomous vehicle accident, I guess you would call it, where an autonomous car acting of its own, like under its own control, was in autonomous mode. There was a human driver, like a human safety officer driver behind the wheel, but the car itself struck a woman crossing a street and killed her. And
oh,
so this
my
is
gosh.
The first casualty. This is the first like casualty related to autonomous vehicles.
Oh, it's so tragic. Was the driver asleep?
You know, I don't really know. It just happened, I think, a few hours ago, so I'm not exactly sure what the details are. But regardless of what actually occurred there, I'm very concerned that the knee-jerk reaction to it is going to be that regulators kick into gear and kick out some regulation that delays autonomous vehicles for 4 years or 5 years or something. That would be a pretty terrible outcome.
Yeah.
'Cause you got to recognize that it's extremely tragic that somebody lost their life, and that's terrible, but the reality is it's going to happen. Car accidents, and like, they're extremely, extremely common. Like, there are a lot of car accidents, and ultimately computers are going to be way better than human beings at driving cars, and there's going to be some mishaps along the way, and that's sad and it's tragic and everything, but it shouldn't be something that would hold up, that should cause us to like hastily react and create laws or regulations that are going to prevent the rollout of cars, like as rapid, or of autonomous cars as rapidly as
absolutely.
Possible.
Absolutely. I mean, my heart goes out to her and her family, not to downplay that whatsoever, but Absolutely. I mean, they're not going to talk about how many pedestrians were hit by a vehicle with a driver behind it. Like, that's not going to make front page news, but because it's an autonomous vehicle.
Exactly. Like, how many other car accidents do you think there are going to be today where somebody is seriously injured or killed? Yeah. Probably hundreds.
Hundreds, I'm sure.
And the only way that we're going to fix that, like, I don't know where automotive, like, related accidents rate in, like, cause of death, like, how many people a year die from car accidents, but whatever that figure is, once we're mostly autonomous, that's going to be fractions of whatever it is today. You know, it's going to probably decrease orders of magnitude once most of the cars on the road are autonomous vehicles and people aren't the ones responsible for driving driving.
Yeah, I just quickly looked this up and it looks like here's an article that came out saying how many deaths there were, pedestrian deaths in 2016. It says pedestrian deaths climbed in 2016. There was a total of 5,000, almost 6,000 pedestrian fatalities.
That's a lot. And I guess that's just people kind of, if it's a pedestrian situation, that means it's somebody just out on the street and they get hit by a car or something?
Correct, yeah. 5,997 to be exact. And actually, that is an 11% increase from the previous year. So
that's interesting. I wonder why that climbed so much.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't due to autonomous vehicles, but I mean, you know, frankly, because they weren't out, obviously. This is the first, so.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, hopefully that doesn't, you know, gum up the works for the rollout of autonomous vehicles, A. And B, I hope that it doesn't super negatively impact, I guess, you know, where it comes to the social star, when it comes to technology getting regulated and big tech getting regulated, I would hope that whatever happens in terms of regulation, that it also doesn't hamper innovation or make it really difficult to build new businesses or to compete or any of that stuff. It gets a little scary.
Yeah.
How about that? Do you think that guy's regretting taking the job at Uber? You know, they got the new CEO after Travis Kalanick, and it just seems like since he got into that position, he's just been leapfrogging from one calamity to the next.
Oh, I mean, you know, it's a big company. They've got a lot of money and a lot of different things that they're rolling out and trying to do between Uber Elevate, between their autonomous vehicles, between just their own regular business and all the logistics around that. I can't imagine.
Yeah.
What those boardrooms look like. I'd love to be a fly on the wall.
Yeah. You would have to be very stressed running that company.
Oh, yeah. Need separate divisions, I probably have, but.
Yeah, competitors like Bird.
Yeah.
they got Bird on their heads. Bird.
yeah. So in other tech news, how about what's going on with YouTube?
Yeah, they're in a lot of hot water.
They are in hot water.
But it's the same old social media and tech story about they're highly, highly optimized to, the whole system is rigged up and optimized to get you to just continually watch and engage and click into the next video and now they're really starting to feel the whiplash from that because so many conspiracy theory type videos and propaganda-ish videos are just getting pushed to people at every turn, and it's becoming what one article called like the most radicalizing force like ever, period.
Oh, wow. Now, we have two separate things going on here, or are these the same thing that's happening? It's just happening on two different platforms with the YouTube Kids app versus just the standard YouTube?
It's kind of the same problem manifesting in multiple places. The kids thing is just so much more egregious. You know, it's bad enough that for regular people, they're constantly being promoted, like videos promoting conspiracy theories and sort of propaganda, and really just like kind of nonsense or very controversial videos. Like, those are the things that are getting pushed to people as suggested content. But YouTube also makes, and that's kind of just regular people, if you're an adult, teenager, whatever, using YouTube as you normally would. But they also have a property for kids. I don't know if it's called YouTube Kids or what, but they have a special app that's built and targeted towards children. And this app has been giving, like, promoting and featuring videos to kids that are conspiracy videos. They're like lizard people are running the earth and flat earther type videos and stuff like that. It's getting promoted as suggested content to children through YouTube. And oh, wow. That's where it just really becomes shameful.
Is that because even with the parental control features and video filters, you can't filter like conspiracy theorist kind of content?
Yeah, I think the challenge there is just the scale. Like, I don't know how you could... I mean, I guess if you had their kind of engineering capacity and money and ability, you could do this. But to me, it seems it would be very difficult to identify a video, a conspiracy video. I mean, maybe if you could sort of like transcribe the audio and search for keywords and just look for stuff like Illuminati or, you know, whatever, these different sort of memes that kind of pop up in that space. And sort of auto flag videos, but ultimately I think the challenge is just the volume of video that goes into YouTube every day, and then the algorithms themselves seem to be kind of like content policy agnostic. They don't really care what the content is. They just care about promoting stuff that gets highly engaged with.
Could they not then create new algorithms for YouTube Kids?
They should. I mean, that's the whole, and that's why this is so offensive and egregious, is because somebody over there should have...
like already thought about that?
Yeah, that should have been so obvious. Prior to this episode? Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, why? Who's calling the shots over there where this is even a thing that could have occurred?
Yeah, especially when children are involved.
Yeah, like you would think that they would have this level of care and sensitivity to the product that adults and normals are all using, but... when you do something like that's for kids, you would think you'd be walking on eggshells to make sure nothing controversial would get into that. But here they've gotten into kind of deep trouble because it's, you know, it's that same failure is occurring there.
What do you think? I mean, how much responsibility do you think we as consumers have of that content? You know, if their algorithm has determined that people are drawn to content that's more extreme than what they started with.
Yeah.
How much responsibility is on us as adults, of course, not children, but as adults, for consuming that content?
I think this is this is going to be like that question is a very fundamental question that separates, it's the kind of thing that separates people the way politics does, where some people are conservative, some people are liberal, and I don't think there's an objective truth or like an objective like where that lands. My feeling personally, having insight into the technology and the methods that are used here, I think that these platforms should be held accountable and have a lot more ultimately, they are employing methods that are built and designed to hijack your rewards system. So like they have teams of psychologists who understand, in the same way that you can train like Pavlov's bell, where you can train a dog to salivate, you know, by ringing a bell, if you just kind of like give it rewards and treats and all this stuff on the right schedule, they've built these experiences that do that to us as human beings. Like you, when you start to use and become engaged with an app like Facebook and a lot of these other highly engineered, highly designed, addictive experiences, you're really losing control of yourself. I mean, it almost to me is, we have this crisis in the United States, like this opioid crisis, where so many people are addicted to painkillers, and it's increasingly becoming evident that part of the problem is that doctors are incentivized to write these prescriptions, sometimes being bribed to write prescriptions for somebody for like these hard painkillers that they might not really need. And people are going to doctors seeking medical advice. They get these prescriptions for painkillers. They get addicted, and this whole thing kind of happens. And it's like that same question you asked about where does the responsibility fall on the consumer for taking or like consuming social media, or the providers for providing it or whatever? I think that same question is kind of true for like that situation with doctors, where it's like, whose responsibility is it? Like, is the consumer responsible because they took the advice and took the painkillers and now they're addicted to it and they have this problem? Or is the moral responsibility on the doctor for having prescribed it in the first place? Because they knowingly prescribed it in this situation where they're making a decision based on personal enrichment, or, you know, somebody somewhere is benefiting from that doctor making that suggestion. And in the case of these social media platforms, it's very similar, where they have a profit motive to get people, their whole profit engine is based on people looking at this stuff and engaging with it. The more time you spend staring at their product, the more money these companies make. And so they're engineering these and designing these experiences to, at all costs, whether it makes you dumber, sadder, whether it steals time from you, negatively impacts your relationships, whatever the cost is, to get you continuing to stare and scroll those feeds and like those photos and share those posts, that's what they're motivated to do. So I think that on one hand, people do have, you should have accountability for how you spend your time and your attention. Everybody's accountable for these things. But on the other hand, I think we're powerless to resist those urges and those temptations with these products, because they're specifically engineered and targeted to wear down your defenses against that. Like, once you're hooked, you're hooked. And
is there a difference, though, between like when I go to a doctor, there's a certain level of trust I expect to have going in, that he's looking out for my best interest because he's a medical professional.
Right.
And on and on. Versus if I go on YouTube or I go on any platform, I don't know, are people trusting these platforms and giving them this trust, thinking like, okay, you're a business, you should be responsible, and looking at them like doctors, whereas they should be going in, okay, you're not someone I trust, and so I'm going to come in like you're out to kill me, basically.
People are, here's the thing, is that, first of all, if you're going to make a product called YouTube Kids, or a product, because Facebook has a messenger product that is designed for kids as well, they have a targeted messenger product for children. And so if you are a big company like one of these guys, YouTube, Facebook, whatever, and you create a product targeted towards children, in the sort of court of Mike, like, you are creating a consumer expectation that this is going to be a safe experience for your kids.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that if you opened up a Chuck E. Cheese with a playpen or whatever, I am sure that there are zoning and regulatory and code things you have to keep that facility and that jungle gym or whatever up to in order for you to continue to operate that business. And because we live in the United States, parents can have a reasonable assumption that, like, if they're going to a business like that, it is being looked after and that it's safe for their kids to go in there and play in that thing. I think that same expectation extends to large tech companies, especially in an environment where there's no competition. Like, there are four huge technology companies that are basically the internet today. It used to be very different, like, 15, 20 years ago. The web was a much more competitive place. But now it's like there's Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and then a few others, you know, next, like a Snapchat, you know, kind of, like, behind those guys. But ultimately, like, that's what there is, and they're not going anywhere.
What about for adults, though?
What about them?
It seems fairly obvious for children, and platforms organized or created for children, but what about for adults? You think that same...
Yeah, I think, I mean, I again, it comes back to this thing where I think that adults should have, you know, I do think that every individual should have accountability for how they spend their time and attention, but I think that adults are just as susceptible to, I don't think that people are immediately understanding how, what these experiences are like. Like, people... If you went into a casino, I would hope that most people, at least, would have their guard up a little bit, understanding that, like, everything that's going to happen to them once they walk through those doors is going to be, like, geared to getting them to spend money or to sort of lose to the house. I don't think people have those expectations going into something like when they open up their Facebook app. People are in there thinking they're sharing photos and looking at status updates from their friends. They're not necessarily thinking that they're being influenced for political ends or even advertised to in a way. Like, I don't know that people are very conscious of this stuff. Their expectations don't match the reality of what's going on there. And I think, I mean, if all of this is really just kind of a conversation around whether, like, should there be government regulation around how these services can operate in the world, I do think that there's something there for sure. Because I just don't think that people can help themselves. Like, I'd rather live in a world where there's a little bit of government regulation around social media companies and how data and all this stuff can be treated, and then have a more empowered populace versus having the status quo continue, which is just people getting manipulated by social media and not really understanding why or how, or having any recourse against it.
It sounds like transparency is the central theme here.
Yeah.
And privacy protection.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that there should be a lot more... People should have a lot more say. At a baseline, people should have a lot more knowledge about what data is available to them. There's a way to go look at your Facebook data somewhere. I know this exists, where somewhere inside of Facebook you can go see, like, all the information they have on you. Google has something like this also. But I think those should be much more accessible and visible. There are areas on both Google's website and on Facebook's where you can see all the information, supposedly, that they have on you. I'm sure there's probably a lot more that they're not showing you, but you can at least see some of the basics of it, and it's really surprising. But yeah, having a little more control over your data and having these companies be a lot more accountable for how it's used is definitely a good thing.
Here's a company that seems to want to do something positive for people when it comes to algorithms. The Wall Street Journal has built a paywall that bends to the individual reader. So what's up with these paywalls?
Well, I think that the publishing industry is certainly really feeling the heat of, I mean, this is what's so crazy too about when tech companies like Facebook have to change the way they operate a little bit in response to, say, political pressure. Like, they made these changes to their algorithms that promote posts from your friends and family and sort of demote posts from news publications. And that little change to the Facebook algorithm has wiped out entire businesses. It's pretty crazy, but it's been good because a lot of the publishing industry is beginning to move toward paywalls and subscriber-based business models instead of advertising-based business models, which is really, really good, I think, for businesses, for the incentives, for all of this stuff. And as part of this migration away from just sort of getting you to look at ads to getting you to pay a couple bucks a month or whatever to subscribe to a newspaper, they're starting to get a lot more sophisticated with when they show you options to sign up for that subscription and stuff like that. And that's what the Wall Street Journal has done here, is they've created, basically they have 60 signals that they use to determine a score of whether you are likely to pay to become a subscriber to the Wall Street Journal. And of those 60 signals, they use things like your location and then the sort of demographic data they can derive from that. They use whether or not you've read articles on the Wall Street Journal before and just all kinds of these different signals to generate a score. And then using that score, they can determine whether they're going to like straight up ask you to start paying or whether they let you continue to read the article for free or whatever the case may be. But it's cool because it's part of this larger transition or migration, I think, of media to user-supported instead of ad-supported, which as a macro internet thing is really, really healthy and really good.
Can we elaborate on that a little bit about people waking up to this direct subscriber support to pay for things they enjoy versus like the ad-driven sources?
Yeah. I would say that the first big wave of these internet services, consumer-facing internet companies, the business model that everybody was in love with was the ad-based business model, where build something and give it to people for free, get tons and tons of traffic and usage and engagement, and then make money on it all by selling ads against that content. This is a really good model to build really large, powerful companies like Facebook. But we're starting to see the negative follow-on effects of making that how all of this works, which is all the controversy we've been talking about pretty much the entire time we've been recording this podcast. And so what publications and content creators are starting to do is starting to, instead of trying to build a large audience and then monetizing that audience with ads, a lot of them are asking folks just to pay a small amount of money, usually every month, like a monthly subscription, and usually in the range of a couple bucks to $5 or $10 a month in order to support the publication of whatever that thing might be. You see a lot of podcasters doing this with like a Patreon kind of thing. Some of my favorite news publications do this, like Stratechery. Ben Thompson's email publication is one of the best, most thoughtful like tech news publications out there. And he does a thing, I think it's $10 a month to subscribe to Stratechery, and it's an email newsletter. And what he'll do is like send out one or two free articles a week, and then the rest are behind a $10 a month paywall. And so that model is really beginning to flourish, I think. I think it was difficult to make that work before because paying online used to be really hard, but now we have awesome stuff like Apple Pay that makes online checkout really, really simple and seamless. And so I think we'll see a lot more like that. I mean, the world's already kind of moving in that direction. You kind of pay Spotify $10 a month. You've got your newspapers that are charging, and it's a good.
You know, on that note, with the music stations, it's obvious, you know, if you pay, then you don't have the ads.
Yeah.
When it comes to other news publications, or at least what you've been consuming, are you finding that to be similar?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like Ben Thompson's thing doesn't have any ads. There's no advertising on Stratechery. Podcasts that I listen to that are Patreon supported don't do ads. That may not be true in every case, but I know at least two of my favorite ones that I listen to don't. They have a Patreon thing with a lot of patrons, and so they don't do ads on the show itself. What they usually do is like they'll do like an after show that's behind a paywall, or they'll do a couple of episodes behind that, like a week or a month that are behind the paywall. And that's a much nicer model for me. For me personally, I would rather pay a podcast that I enjoy $5 a month to have an ad-free listening experience or to access all that content or whatever versus listening to ads for like Squarespace or mattresses or whatever. I don't know if that's a universal thing, but that's certainly my preference.
Now, that's great for stopping ads and getting advertised to, especially online. Oh my gosh. I mean, I don't think anyone enjoys opening up a web page and then having like 30 things jump out at you on both sides of a column. But that doesn't necessarily stop them from collecting data and doing whatever with that data.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I think that the interesting thing is that if you take the ad part of it out of the equation, so like if say there was a new platform came out today, you know, a version of Facebook where instead of it being ad supported, it was just based on user subscriptions and micropayments. As that company invests in its research and development roadmap and chooses where to invest money and build technology out, there would be little or no payoff in investing tons of that brain power into building out their ad capabilities and ad targeting and data collection capabilities, because those aren't going to move the needle in the same way on conversions. So Facebook, like OG original, like, or Facebook itself, like so much of their money and so much of the technology that they've built there is all about, it's really just a surveillance company. Because that ability to target ads is what drives all the money for them. In a situation where user subscriptions was the way that money, like that was what was driving that revenue, that company, instead of investing on like ad tech and spying tech, would probably invest in methods to get content creators to be more successful and to create better content that results in more people paying for it to subscribe to it. So it's just about creating the right incentives, I think, to get outcomes where you're not getting into something creepy. Cook, 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 cook.